dying embers of human existence as the asteroid, a behemoth the size of Texas, hurtles relentlessly toward Earth. The world braces for an apocalyptic end. Deep beneath the bunker, a refuge plunges into the bowels of the Earth. Here the Chosen gather, their purpose clear, to preserve the very soul of our civilization. The 35 and 70 millimeter prints that encapsulate the magic, the emotion, and the dreams of generations past. These masterpieces, each frame a testament to the human spirit, are carefully cataloged and cradled in the cavernous confines of the bunker. Perhaps there was room for more. For friends and family yearning for salvation, but sacrifices must be made. The movie nerds stand united, the keepers of a flame, promising a future where the art of storytelling endures, transcending the boundaries of time and space. God help us all.
Welcome to Back to the Framerate, part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. In the cinematic crusade, we journey through films on VOD and streaming platforms, deciding their fate, salvation in our vault of legends, or eternal banishment to the flames of the coming asteroid apocalypse. You can find all episodes of our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, or find us on social media at Back to the Framerate. I am Nathan Shore, and accompanying me is the mayor of Shark City, Sam Cole.
Amity means friendship. We need summer dollars.
We do. We need your dollars, everyone. Send them over. Yeah. Sam, how are you doing? It's good to be back.
I'm doing great. It's amazing to be back. It's been a little while. It's been about 6 months. But dare I say, do you realize that at this exact moment, do you know what we are doing? We are, in fact, going back to the frame rate.
We are.
Literally.
I don't want to confuse the people out there. We're doing this as a one-off episode. We might do this again sometime when we feel like it, but this is a special episode because I think you and I can agree this episode, we're going to be talking about Jaws. It is a special time because it is the 50th anniversary of it. We're recording this on June 18th, and it's going to become, this episode will come out in like 5 days or so, but June 20th, 1975, Jaws comes out. I don't know. I think this is considered the first like real blockbuster when people look back at the history of this. So this is, I think this kind of defines what we're all about as cinema goers, cinema lovers. This has had a profound impact on my life. I know it did on yours.
Oh God. Yes. Yes.
This movie has just infiltrated the zeitgeist, the way it was shot, the cinematography, the quotes in this, it's the acting. This will be a lot of fun to dissect. I worry, though, what are we going to add to this? I know.
It's like, by the way, this movie's really good.
Yeah.
I will address the elephant in the room. As we all know, the best motion picture ever made is 1988's The Great Outdoors. But so we've decided to give Jaws a pity review because it came out in 1975.
Yeah.
And no one saw it. So join us as we review the shitter.
Exactly. Let's see. Well, I guess we got to get into this. We're out of practice, everyone. We don't really know what we're doing because after 6 months, it's like, how do we begin a show? All I know is that some guy named Steven Spielberg directed this. We have reviewed a couple of his films on Back to the Frame Rate. Yes. In fact, I think he might be winning as far as the amount of movies we've reviewed of his. We've done Duel. We've done War of the Worlds. We did Amistad. What was in that retrospective? I'm trying to think what else.
We did Amistad, Duel, War of the Worlds, and Empire of the Sun, I think. Yeah.
Empire of the Sun. Was there one more? We started it all off with Always, though.
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, of course, you know what we did? We also went through the whole Indiana Jones franchise, too.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah, yeah, that was really cool.
And so this film, 1975, it was directed by Steven Spielberg, produced by Richard Zanuck, David Brown, screenwriters Carl Gottlieb. The book was written by Peter Benchley. And I think he also did some of the screenwriting on this as well. John Williams, the composer this. Bill Butler, the cinematographer. Yeah. And of course, I feel silly just going through the main players in this because they're Everybody knows these, you know, Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss were the main players in this. But when I look at like the deep cuts of the people in this, like Murray Hamilton, Mayor Vaughn is incredible in this. Lorraine, Gary, Ellen Brody. I don't know. There's just, it's just really wonderful casting up and down this movie. And I was actually kind of looking at some of the other information on here. I don't know, Sam, if you prepared any movie facts. Like, we didn't really
I was going to say, literally, I just bought like a newer edition of the Jaws log. And I had an old copy which I borrowed from a friend and never returned. I still feel terrible about that. But I've been reading it recently. And literally, it's fascinating. Things I didn't even know. Like Charlton Heston really wanted Roy Scheider's role. And the producers didn't want to go with him because he was in big blockbusters like Airport 75.
Yeah.
And then another movie. And they thought that he was too large of a personality. So they're like, what does gigantic star Charlton Heston want to do with a small seaside New England community? But Carl Gottlieb actually, and I literally just read this like 2 days ago, Peter Benchley wrote the first three drafts of the screenplay. Spielberg liked certain scenes, but they were worried like the characters weren't developed enough. Carl Gottlieb was going to act in it, and he did. He was put on the payroll as a screenwriter in late April of 1974, right before they started shooting. And while they were casting some actors in Boston, he was in like a next door suite with a typewriter, furiously typing pages per Spielberg's like instruction and oversight. So Carl Gottlieb and Spielberg really are responsible for like putting more depth into the characters, improving the dialogue. Like, I think they really just went at those drafts and fixed them. And they had to start shooting as they were rewriting. Like, it was terrifying because they had to film like they were out of time and like the script wasn't even quite there yet. So it was like
right
by the seat of their pants kind of thing, like impressive.
And I think I read that they were up against a writer's strike or an act?
Yes.
A strike that was happening in the summer of 1973. And they had to do this in the spring of that year. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do it. And
right.
So this was like a race against time to get it done in the spring of 73, I believe. So it was.
They shot in, like, they were shooting in 74. So they, in this.
Was it 74? Like, oh, okay, maybe.
It
yeah.
was. And then, okay. like, and so December 73, like, Spielberg met with Richard Zanuck and David Brown. Martha's Vineyard, they were shooting spring of 74.
Okay.
And they scheduled all the beach filming scenes in like early May. What they didn't realize is the water is freezing then.
And yeah.
They had to push that back on the schedule at one point, and I'm glad they didn't do this. I thought this would have been ridiculous, but they were going to have stuntmen in like scuba outfits, but like painted like skin to go swimming as like background extras. That's a terrible idea. And so the schedule, they had to push it all around. You notice at the beginning of the movie, like there's a lot of, it doesn't detract in any way, but there's a lot of like land dialogue scenes where if you look in the background, there's no leaves on the trees. Like it's the 4th of July and they're shooting in like early May and it's still pretty cold. Like everyone's in jackets. It's cold.
Oh, everyone. Yeah. Everyone is in. Yeah. They're.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's just like, it's you, if you look for it, it's there. Yeah.
A couple other things I just noted here. It had a budget of $9 million. Originally, it was supposed to be projected to be about $4 million. And opening weekend made $7 million, but grossed in its original run, $260 million, I think I saw here somewhere. Worldwide, $470 million. And this is over the course of all its re-releases or so. But it's one of the most profitable films of all time. So yeah, until Star Wars, I think, superseded
until it. Star Wars, they literally had a 55-day production schedule and it ballooned to 150 days. Like it was, Spielberg describes literally waking up with panic attacks, wondering if they were going to get a single shot that day. Like that movie literally like made his career. Like it was a trial by fire movie, like in a kind of metaphorical way. I feel like once he went through the hell of that, it made him like battle hardened. And then turned him into like Steven Spielberg of today. Like it was a trial by fire. He was 27 years old. It blows my mind.
I know. What have you done with your life, huh?
I know. Oh my God. Oh God. I made a YouTube skit called Attack of the Phone and I added some laser effects to it. Woo.
Right. Looking at some of the awards, it did get a couple. Best film editing, it won. Best original score, which rightfully so. And best sound. It got nominated for best picture. Did not win, lost out to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And also nominated was Barry Lyndon, Dog Day Afternoon, and Nashville. That was a tough competition that year. But Spielberg did not get nominated. I think there's a famous video, you can actually see it on YouTube, yes, where he's filming himself waiting for the call that he got nominated.
I've seen that, and it's like, yeah. I feel so much empathy for him, because he's sitting there and he's like, what do we get nominated for? And one of them was best screenplay. He's like, best screenplay? That's it? And then he's like, this is what they call, I forget the phrase, but there's a quote and he says something like, everybody likes a winner, but nobody likes a winner.
But you know what? It was tough competition that year because Kubrick got nominated. Sidney Lumet got nominated. Robert Altman got nominated. Fellini got nominated. Milos Forman got nominated and won for Cuckoo's Nest. So, Spielberg should have gotten nominated.
He should have. And also at that time, he was like the new kid on the block, like young hotshot guy. These are like established directors that were like, had been around.
These are legends in the industry, all these guys. Yeah. He got his later. Okay. I was looking at this though, like no acting nominations. And I'm not that surprised, but I would say Robert Shaw should have gotten a nomination.
He was great
in this. So that's the only thing I probably could have, I think should have got an acting nomination, but whatever.
I don't remember. I can't remember the name of the director. Like, I think they kept this guy's name out of like to hide his embarrassment, but there was some other diehard like action director or a director that they were like trusting the two producers to do the movie. But when they kept interviewing this director, like at a dinner with him, he kept referring to the shark as a whale. He was like, the whale does this and the whale does that. And like Richard Zanuck was like, no, it's a shark. It's a shark. And so at the end of that, like lunch meeting, they were like, nah, not this guy.
Well, let's talk about the film a little bit here. If anyone, spoilers for Jaws, we'll put that out there right now. It's about a shark. You know, this, I watched this again, probably for like the, I don't know, 40th time this past week. I always still find things that surprise me. When you watch a movie that many times, you start to like almost not follow the main plot line. And you start to look at like, what are the background actors doing? What is all these other things happening? And which is fascinating because I know this movie backwards and forwards now, but it's wonderful catching all the little nuances. And actually later on, I'm going to mention something that a little interaction I never picked up before, but it was such a great character moment that I discovered, which was amazing. But first thing I just want to talk about, like, the cinematography in this film is just incredible. And I don't think people like go to that initially. I think they think about the story, the horror of this and some of the shock value of this and maybe and probably some of the acting, but this is just shot so incredibly well. And I think it even starts in the very beginning, the way that they stage this opening death scene with, was it Chrissy? What's the girl's name?
Oh, Chrissy Watkins. Yeah.
Chrissy Watkins. The way this is staged in that opening is incredible. I mean, I noticed something though that I don't think I ever caught before. There's this visual continuity in the beach scenes that is just out of sequence and doesn't really make any sense. Sometimes the sun is setting like over the ocean horizon, then it's setting like, or I don't know if it's sunrise or sunset, I'm not too sure, but then it's like over the beach the other way. And sometimes the sky is like completely like cast over, and then like there's this beautiful golden like sun behind a cloud. It's all gorgeous, so it doesn't matter, but I never really noticed like how the continuity in all this is like all out of whack. But screw it. I mean, I don't think anybody really notices this.
I totally hear that, like it's a little discombobulated, but I think it's because they were just trying to find a way to have a little bit of light so you could see what's going on. So it's like when they're on the beach, it's like the dead of night. When they're running by the fence, it's like gray twilight. When the drunk guy falls down, he's like, take it easy. It's like sunset or sunrise in the background. It's just kind of like trickery to make it visible. I think they chose that as opposed to doing straight up like day for night, which would kind of flatten it, even though they kind of messed around with it. Like, yeah.
Totally. Every shot is gorgeous. I don't think it's even that noticeable, but it's just like everything's beautiful. But it's funny that they just used what they could to get the best looking shots. It didn't matter if they probably shot this over three or four different days or nights. They just got great looking coverage and footage of all of this.
It's so atmospheric. It just sets the tone. And when she gets like brutally eaten, that just sets that feels so terrifyingly realistic. What I love about that scene is it doesn't feel like there's like 70s slasher flicks where the murders are not campy, but when she dies, there's something about it where it sets the tone for the rest of the movie, and you watch her drowning and you picture what's going on underneath her. Mm. And it's really every single time it's unsettling to me. And I've seen the movie a million times, and you just feel like you're watching someone die right in front of you. And it's like, oh my God, it sets the tone.
I agree. Yeah. I also contrasting that, but also setting the tone is how we are introduced to Amity Island. And I love this. I mean, we are both from New England, and you've been to Martha's Vineyard where this was shot many times. I almost think of you as like this being maybe your second or third home. You're there so much, you know, but I love in the very beginning and Amity say Yod, and it's just a humorous bit of regional flavor that just sets the location and the tone for this. And then you got that billboard, Amity Island welcomes you, 50th annual regatta, July 4th. Yes. So you set this location, a time of the year, and it kind of adds like this little tension. We know something deadly lurks beneath the surface, and even as this town is preparing for the celebration. So I just love this. It was funny. I was re-watching one of the documentaries. They had to construct that whole sign, shoot all that, and then take it down all in one day. That was because Martha's Vineyard is very strict with the rules about filming there. This is the first film that ever had any major film production coming through there. I don't know how many others have shot. I know Nantucket has had a lot more productions out there. I don't know about Martha's Vineyard, though.
Martha's Vineyard is really strict. Even Quint's house, like when they go there to Quint's place before they go off.
That was constructed, right?
It was constructed, but it was right on the border, I think, between Menemsha and Chilmark, and there were all these like laws, and they were not getting permission to build it, and there was going to be a board of review in 4 months' time. So what they did was they built it and they filmed all the scenes before the board of review occurred, and then they took it down and were like, what are you talking about? That we didn't build anything, we're done. Like they had so much, and not only that, but there were islanders that like were lending them boats and doing transportation, but then they realized how small their pay was compared to the filmmaker's pay. So they boycotted. But what they didn't realize is that the filmmakers were getting paid more, because in Hollywood productions, you're not working all the time. So when you have a movie, you tend to get paid more. So there was a whole scale thing. So the business negotiations, which I knew nothing about, I'm literally only reading it in the Jaws log, I was like, oh my God, they had some logistical nightmares on that island.
Wow. Yeah. What else? I mean, this movie also, when I think about it, is just so great at just setting the tone, setting the scene for like another example is like we talked about the background characters, not just getting to know the main ones, but like all the background extras and all the little scenes in the shops and Brody walking around town and interacting with them. These little minor characters, they feel like they're so lived in. And I know several years before this, Robert Altman made the whole thing about cross dialogue very famous, even kind of controversial with like MASH and things like that.
Right.
But I love what Spielberg does in this movie, because I like Altman, but it also is kind of, sometimes it's a lot to take in and difficult to enjoy when you've got six conversations all crossing over one another. But somehow Spielberg was able to take that kind of idea and refine it in this film. And I love all of these, the like, what we're trying to say. when the select board or when all these people are getting together, having these town meetings and stuff like that, and all this cross chatter, but you actually can pick out these conversations. It's not just a big jumbled mess. And I think he does a fantastic job with the writing of this and the dialogue and the way it's sound mixed as well. And all these characters, you really know what their motivations are. Their woman's like concerned about, like, are you going to close the beaches? And everyone's interested in these, in their business. And it really paints a really detailed picture of this community and their concerns. And I really just love how well it's fleshed out, all of these minor characters. And you only sometimes see them for like a moment. The guy that, you know, that Brody says that's a bad hat, Harry. I forgot that we see him at least one or two of the times before that. Like, it rewards you on multiple viewings, seeing all these side characters, little characters that keep popping up.
There's such a naturalism to it, too. When you watch all these characters and the overlapping dialogue, I feel like I'm watching real life unfold on the island. When there's family scenes, it doesn't feel stagey. It just, you know, the wonderful thing about Spielberg's direction is, of course, it's directed and of course it's blocked. But the manner in which it unfolds, you feel as if you're witnessing real life on this island. And somehow through this invisible camera, you just happen to see what's actually taking place. And one thing that I thought was awesome that I was literally reading in the Jaws log was early on, before they were shooting or anything, when Spielberg was talking to Richard Zanuck and David Brown, his specific MO about the directing, he said, he demanded it. He said, in this movie, we have to be able to see the shark, the three actors, and the ocean and the horizon all in the same shot, as opposed to cutting to a close-up of a shark and then cutting to a close-up of a face. And I realized, oh my God, that style of directing is what Steven Spielberg does in all his films to different degrees.
Yeah.
But one of the things that feels so amazing about Jaws that makes it feel so real, there's no moments that feel stagey or they have those kind of cliche horror buildups. You're literally watching shots where the shark will just pop into and you're not expecting it to be there. You'll see it in the background or your eye will be drawn to one place, but it's because it's so immersive like that, that there's so much going on in a single angle that just sets a whole atmosphere and feel for the whole film.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think spot on, Sam, and there's so much of that. And he uses so many amazing techniques as well. I think it's on full display a little bit late in at the beach scene. One of the first beach scenes where you get a lot more of these character interactions. You get those like split diopter shots. And of course, this is the scene with the Alex Kintner death as well, which we should talk about for a moment. But you got that amazing like Dolly zoom shot. All these trickery. And even before that, it's so well staged because you've got Brody, who's like, he's already on edge. He's scanning the beach and you feel the anxiety peaking. People are passing by and you've got so much visual tension mounting here. And what Spielberg has done here, I was reading that he really wanted this whole thing to be a single take, which would have been great. That would have been, but he kind of does it because he uses like people passing by and you see like these bathing suits passing in front of Roy Scheider. And by using that, it's like these wipes that then you punch in on his face more and more. And these are cuts, but it creates this tension focusing in on his eyes. And it just raises the anxiety that we see in him. But also prior to that, we're introduced to these characters and we just realize this tension just keeps mounting throughout the whole thing. But let's talk about Alex's death, because this is a technical marvel as well. This attack, it's like graphic and it's chaotic. What I love about this, and I don't mean to hijack all this, but like I would just love kind of like how avant-garde this is as well. Cause you see the blood spraying and we get just a subtle glimpse of the shark, but it's so fragmented and the horror comes from not really understanding what's going on. Him get taken under, but you see like the shark kind of roll over him a little bit. But the real horror is in everyone's reaction And everyone has kind of a different reaction. And nobody really fully understands what just happened. And it's just such a great piece of visual storytelling.
It's incredible. And also, like, that whole scene with his death, what you were talking about with the wipes, it puts you inside Brody's headspace because he's sitting there and he's so nervous and uptight because he knows there's a shark and he knows no one else, everyone else is oblivious. And so the guy comes up and starts talking to him and is like, hey, I need you to check this zoning issue. And then the girl in the background is like, ah, and it's her boyfriend coming up beneath her, or yeah, someone is swimming beneath someone else. And so when Alex Kittner does die and you see the shark roll over and it cuts to reaction shots and you see him dragged down with like a fountain of blood spurting up, Roy Scheider's worst fears are consumed. And that's when it's like the zoom in and the pullback shot on Roy Scheider's face and everyone is confused. Again, it has that real world point of view feeling, because if it was in the hands of a different director, not necessarily a bad director, the Alex Kittner's death would have been more on the nose, or there would have been this kind of hyped up sort of money shot. But when you see the shark roll over, your view is kind of blocked. So you know something happened, but you can't quite see it. And you're like, wait a minute. Oh my God, did that just happen? And it makes it realistic and worse and more intense, because if an attack like that happened on a beach in real life, there would be confusion. You would be like, did I just see that? Like, it's got that real life feeling of like, oh my God, what's going on here?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's a wonderfully shot. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Yeah.
I love that scene. And like you, I've watched this movie a million times. And one thing I notice in general that it does really well thematically is you have two worlds in this movie. You have the human world on the island, and they're all focused on modern human things like the economy and summer dollars and bureaucratic issues. And then but they're on an island surrounded by the ocean, and the ocean is the ancient world. And there's many shots at the beginning when, like, if you see Roy Scheider, you see Chrissy Watkins' hand in the sand. Roy Scheider kind of just turns behind him and just looks out at the ocean. And the movie really gives you a sense that almost like, not, I mean, this is like a metaphor, but like, it's like in Puritan times or way in the past, if there's a little Walden village in the middle of this like ancient forest, there's mystery out there and they're on the shore of another world. And the movie really leans into that. And that's why I like it when they do go out after the shark. Finally, they're going into the shark's ancient world, and that's when you hear whale noises and you see shooting stars and you, oh my God, we're going into, there's this underlying like mythology might not be the right world, but like the human world is new and the shark world is ancient. And this movie is about the two worlds colliding as a shark literally feeds on humans. So it operates on that deeper level really well. Like, and especially if you see it in the movie theater again, when this thing is on a big screen, that sense of the mysteries of the ocean is like expanded. It's just, it's really amazing.
Well said, Sam. Yes. I'm gonna take one moment here. I'm gonna play a clip, we'll take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more. I love this little thing here. I saved this conversation with Brody and the mayor.
And a pen, Larry.
Yeah, a pen, you know.
Because you're going to do what you do best. You're going to sign this voucher so I can hire a contractor.
I don't know if I can do that without...
I'm going to hire Quint to kill the shark.
What?
August. What? What are you talking about? Larry, the summer is over. You're the mayor of Shark City. These people think you want the beaches open.
I love the mayor so much, and he is like just a bureaucratic tool.
Oh, he's great. Yeah.
He is great. And he's got some of the best quotes here. Of course, you brought it up in the very beginning, this one.
I'm pleased and happy to repeat the news that we have, in fact, caught and killed a large predator that supposedly injured some bathers. But as you see, it's a beautiful day. The beaches are open and people are having a wonderful time. Amity, as you know, means friendship.
literally when he arrived on the island to play Mayor Vaughn, his first few nights, he went out, and this story has so many iterations, like it's told over and over again and written. So it's probably not entirely accurate, but he had several drinks. And before shooting, he's on his way walking back to his hotel room, and he sees what he thinks is a cat. So he goes down to pet it. It's a skunk. He gets sprayed. And on his first day of filming, he stinks. Like, he just smells to high heaven. And everyone is like, oh, God, like holding their nose doing scenes with him. So unfortunately, it was not a cat.
What else? We haven't talked about some of the other characters show up here. So Richard Dreyfuss. Hooper arrives here. Yeah, he is so good in this. And I like how everybody is so good at counterbalancing the other characters in this. The trifecta of Hooper, Quint, and Brody is just so balanced in this. So he kind of like punctures like the town's denial in this. And I love his humor and contrast. And because Brody is very reserved. And
yes,
so I just love, he's the one that's already coming in there saying this is not a boating accident. He knows what's going on. By the way, Ben Gardner, I just want to mention one thing. For the longest time, I was so confused. Ben Gardner and Quint, I think when I was a young kid, I thought they were the same actor, the same character.
I can see that. Yeah, I can understand that.
Ben Gardner was a local. I didn't realize this until recently. Right. He's not an actor. And I saw an interview with Steven Spielberg. If he couldn't get Robert Shaw, Ben Gardner was on the second tier of list of actors that could have been cast to play Quint. Although I don't think he would have done nearly as well, but he's not a true actor, but he was authentic. He was the real deal.
That's cool. He definitely had the look. It's just when it comes to Robert Shaw, who had that gravitas, especially with some of his dialogue. It's funny. I will say there's so many incredible shots in this movie. I will mention a shot that I think is my least favorite shot in the movie that I find cheesy. Okay. It's not that bad because like the movie's like 100%. So it's like I struggle to find it. But I think it's Ben Gardner and another guy, and they're on a dock, and they put the hook into the roast. And they throw it out into the ocean. This is when the shark rips off the dock.
Gardner's not one of those two kids.
That's right. He's not one of those two. Yeah. I confused that. So the two guys in the dock, I love that whole sequence. There is one shot, just one, where you see the chain flying away into the water. And the camera zooms in on the one guy who's whistling. And he stops whistling. And he looks at the chain being pulled into the water. And he's like, "Who? What?" And it's just the cheesiest reaction. There's like a kind of a zoom there that I don't like. This shot, I'm talking about a 4-second shot, but like trying to analyze it, I'm like, that is the one shot in the movie. I just think, because the guy's like, "Duh, what's going on here?"
Interesting. I don't recall exactly. But speaking of that scene, there is one of the greatest moments of the movie, I think, takes place when that pier is ripped off and is going out to sea, and one of those two characters falls into the water. And it's almost like Hitchcockian, how that pier slowly turns around and comes back. You don't see the shark, but your imagination seeing that and that suspense of building, you don't know. You assume that guy's not going to make it. And I think even though I've saw this movie several times growing up, I kept thinking that guy does not make it.
That whole scene is incredible. Like I'm just being nitpicky with that one shot. It's just a zoom in on the guy's face when he stops whistling. But when the dock turns around, it is so suspenseful. And that to me is scarier than seeing an actual underwater, because your imagination, and this will sound like sacrilegious to like some like film students and lovers of film, but there is a lot of Hitchcockian suspense in this movie. And in this movie, and music. And in this movie in particular, I actually feel that Spielberg bests Hitchcock in this one particular film, Jaws, because I love Hitchcock. I love a lot of his films, but his characters are colder and the dialogue can be a little bit stiffer. Spielberg has incredible Hitchcockian suspense mixed with human empathy. And the warmth of these characters that you care about, and the blending of that makes for just an incredible movie experience.
Yes. And I think that kind of segues into another scene that I want to mention, which is a very memorable scene. And that is when we skipped through a few things here, but I love it's a very quiet moment, very quiet scene back at Brody's house where it's a dinner scene. And it's actually preceded with a really nice moment with his son where he's doing the whole thing with the hands. And
I love that.
And he's got a really cool, you know, moment where like, give your dad a kiss or something like that because I need it. Because he really felt like I needed it at that moment too.
Oh, yeah.
And but this dinner table scene, I just love Hooper comes in with a lot of energy and he's dressed up, which is kind of funny. And I just really think this is one of the two moments that I laughed out loud with this line delivery that I never really picked up before. And it's when Hooper is talking to, he's talking to Ellen, and Brody's not really safe. He's really quiet and he's just opening the wine, pours like a gigantic glass. And this is what I always find funny is that I actually captured this dialogue and this cracked me up.
They caught a shark, not the shark. Not the shark that killed Chrissy Watkins. And probably not the shark that killed the little boy. Which I wanted to prove today by cutting the shark open, but you want to let that breathe for nothing.
And I know it's so simple, but like it's those little moments that there's so much humor in this, and I feel like that probably was not in the script. Like, you want to let that breathe a little bit? Oh, nothing.
Right.
But it's those little character moments that I don't think I ever really laughed at that scene before, that piece of dialogue before. I like rolled over in my chair watching it that time because, of course, Hooper would be like, pause his story to like, you know, this, you got to let that breathe. And that's the wine is important. So
that scene is hysterical. I also love it when Hooper is like, is anyone eating this? And he just like takes the food. Like he basically invites himself in. He's like, I didn't know red or white. I didn't know what you guys would be serving. And like when I was younger, like I loved and enjoyed the scene. But as an adult watching it now, you realize just how like drunker and drunker Brody gets through the course of the night. Like first he pours this big tall glass. And then when it cuts to him on the boat, he's like, I'm telling you, the crime rate in New York will kill you. Ripoffs, muggings, but in Amity, one man can make a difference. And you're like, oh my God, I never noticed before that he is literally like three sheets to the wind in this scene. Which and then
he ends it all with, I can do anything. I'm the chief of police.
Love that. But there's a subtle like, there are tons of those. There's even a little moment like jumping around for a sec, but when they're in Quint's shack, Quint like makes his own drink. And Brody has it and he's like, this is awful. And it's so subtle and it's so quick. You barely catch it, but he hands it to, he's like,
don't drink that.
Richard Dreyfuss grabs. He's like, don't drink that. He's like, this is awful. Yes. It's like, it's awful.
You brought something up that I actually didn't catch that. I caught before, but what I want to say is also about the acting. We could jump ahead to the acting performance of Robert Shaw, but this is something I never caught before. And I love this so much. And it is that moment. I have a note on this here because it's really about the overall, like what I want to call is like face acting, which is maybe like a really simple way of putting this, but it's the subtext in a lot of the performances here. Quint, when Quint offers Brody that homemade drink, I don't know if it's moonshine or it probably is like something like that or ethanol. Who knows what it is?
Right.
Like you said, he sips it in, but Quint, what I never really picked up before is Quint's reaction to when Brody drinks it. And Quint sees through the whole thing. His smile fades. And it's not about the drink. It's kind of like a test of Brody's spirit. And Quint is silently judging Brody. And when he sees that, he doesn't like it. He has no words, but he does this brilliant, like we see his like smile kind of like fade. And he like, this is not, he's not seaworthy or he's not one of, and if you watch that scene, and it's a little hard to see because it's kind of like soft focus, I think, when Quint's back there. But it's an amazing moment where like he drinks it. He's like, okay. And it's such a beautiful character moment from Robert Shaw.
That I love that character. Yeah. No, I hear. I love those character moments. And like you were saying earlier, there's such a good, gritty, like lived in feel to this movie. Like I enjoy Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park to me is shinier. It's more like clean and it has a different feel. This movie, there's like, it feels like there's dirt and dust and it's like Bill Butler cinematography. Everything is so rich. You just reminded me of that when you said that was sort of that soft focus shot on Quint. But there's such a lived in gritty feel to this that like Quint's house, when you're there, even though the place like was built and destroyed really quick, you feel like he's been living there for like 10 years on that island, just in a brief scene. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I actually wrote notes on when they hire Quint, what Quint's demands were. Did you ever like write these down and make note of what they are? He's getting what, $10,000 plus expenses, including $200 a day. Case of apricot brandy, champagne, pâté foie gras, Iranian caviar, and a color TV.
I love the color TV. It's like, oh, a color TV. Wow. Between the three of them, there's like testosterone on the boat, but there's also a little bit of like an undercurrent of like class warfare, because it's like Richard Dreyfuss, young, rich kid, rich family, and like Robert Shaw is resentful and he's like a working class fisherman and he respects Chief Brody because Brody is like a chief and a cop and he's nicer to him, and him and Richard Dreyfuss don't get along. But in real life too, they were very competitive. Like in real life, they were at each other's, not at each other's throats, but the sense that I get is Richard Dreyfuss was a lot nicer. Robert Shaw was definitely drinking too much. And he would be like, hey, Richard, why don't you go like climb to the top of the mast? Like, I dare you to do that. So that competition kind of bled off the screen a little bit. Not quite competition, but just like they butted heads a lot. And Roy Scheider was kind of quieter. Famously, I think there was one scene where they were trying to film something and Roy Scheider took Robert Shaw's like bottle or liquor or glass out of his hand and threw it into the ocean, and all the crew was like, because they were worried that he was going to be really mad.
Yep. What else? Let's get into the boat. You know, Orca that sets sail again. One of the greatest shots film history. That Orca pulling out of the harbor, looking for the shark's mouth. And I love that music. Also, it's actually kind of like Williams. Part of the score was really uplifting, I remember.
Yes.
I love that.
I also love how, like, in another movie, them going out to catch the shark would be, like, the last 20 minutes. And technically, it's the beginning of the third act, but it's, like, the whole second half of the film is a different movie on that boat. And that's why I like it, because you have all the characters, dizzying amounts of characters on the island. You almost feel like the movie could continue to go in that direction where they're trying to cover it up and then reporters are coming in and the shark maybe kills someone else. But instead, the three of them go out on the boat and the movie becomes this like old man on the sea adventure. And structurally, I love that. Just the way this movie flows and how it's almost split down the middle between the populated first half and the three of them on the open ocean for like the last 45 minutes of the movie. I love that. Like, that's when I saw it as a little kid, then I forgot about it. When I saw it again, when I was 13, it was that whole second half where I was just like, this movie is incredible.
Yeah. And actually it is pretty much bisected in half, but each half has its own three act structure also.
Right.
Which is pretty cool. So it's almost like a six act movie, but yeah, it is. Yes, it is unusual in its structuring. Yeah. So yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'm just amazed with the difficulty of the production and the writing and rewriting of the script while they were shooting. It's amazing how well this movie turned out. Sometimes when there's production disasters, you can feel some of that anguish on the screen. Totally different movie, has nothing to do with this. Big fan of David Fincher. I find Alien 3 atmospheric and fascinating. I enjoyed the movie, but when you watch it, you can feel the tough making of it and disjointed scenes. Jaws worked out so well that the difficult making of it is so legendary because it turned out so amazingly. When you hear about what went into making that movie and what it was like shooting it. It's a wonder they left the island with any footage. They would, they weren't even aware of tides. They would set up shots. The boat would drift and like sailboats would go by and they'd have to start over. Like it was a nightmare.
Yep. All right. One more clip. Take a quick break. Then we'll wrap up our discussion in the for Jaws.
You go inside the cage. Cage goes in the water. You go in the water. Shark's in the water. Our shark. Farewell and adieu to you fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu, you ladies of Spain. For we've received orders for to sail back to Boston. And so never more shall we see you again.
The best part about that is Hooper, who's smiling, and I think just wants to punch him in the face.
Yeah, he's smiling. He's like, this guy, man, this friggin' guy is too much. I think my favorite shot in the whole movie, and I wanted to give a shout out to our mutual friend, John Trafton. He has a podcast. This movie saved my life. They did
great.
They just did a Jaws review. I have a little self-interest because I had a little cameo appearance on it, but his favorite shot as well as mine, it's only a 5-second shot. It is Quint against the silhouetted against the sunset on the Orca.
Yeah.
And like Brody is like, but we should radio in and we should go back. And the scene just abandons him and cross dissolves. And it's just him black against the sunset. It's not even this like wide spectacular money shot. It just sets such a mood. I was hypnotized by that shot as a kid. And that's one of my favorite shots. It just, there's something about it. I interpreted it as, and this is just me. I mean, obviously this is not the meaning of the shot at all, but for me, watching it when I was younger, when I was 13, and I saw Quint against the twilight sky, it seemed to be like a portent of things to come. And I got this feeling of like, this is the beginning of Spielberg's career, and there's amazing things out there on the horizon. That shot just gives me this feeling, which still to this day, it gives me the chills. I just, it's like 5 seconds long, but I love it.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. No, what else happens on this boat that we can talk about? There's a lot of just so many great moments here. I love the beer can plastic cup moments.
That was written. That was Carl Gottlieb wrote that. And like they were trying to entice Richard Dreyfuss because he came to Boston and he'd just done this movie called like The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz, which he did not like. And Carl Gottlieb in the Jaws log says apparently it's kind of a poorly made film, but well acted. I've never seen it. Richard Dreyfuss said he liked the script, but like he wanted to watch the movie rather than be in it. And they were trying to entice him. And Spielberg literally said, I don't want to make a film. I want to make a movie. And Jaws is really a great, Jaws is a movie. It's a movie.
I remember watching that interview with Richard Dreyfuss where he said that same thing. This is a film he wants to watch, not be in. And then he was, I think the movie came out that he was in the previous movie he was in. And he said that he saw his face in really big on the screen. And he's like, oh my God, I'm terrible. And he's like, oh my God, I got to take whatever movie I can get next. So he called up Steven Spielberg, like, I'll take it. I'll take it. Whatever it is, I'll take it. Yeah. And he's in Jaws. So
it's amazing. And I love how
worked for his career.
He's like, oh my God, I got to do something quick before they find out how terrible this is. But like, I love how Spielberg is so focused on entertaining the audience. Cause like everything on the boat starts out suspensefully, but once he's got you locked in and you're buying the concept and you're just on board for Jaws, the climax gets larger than life. I mean, the shark goes under the boat. It's dragging the boat. The boat is sinking and the three barrels are chasing them into shore as Quint. I also like how cleverly they invent problems to get the situation worse for them. So Quint destroys the radio, his baseball bat, which obviously could have saved them. And then Quint, because of his ego, pushes the ship too hard. So Quint, in a sense, creates problems for the suspense to get worse. And so when he has this horrific death, there's kind of this poetic justice of like, oh my God, he survived the Indianapolis only to get eaten by Jaws in the end. It's like a vicious circle. It's his character arc. Like he went down with the beast, like Ahab.
The whole Ahab comparison is all over this. And I think that there's something that, in fact, I want, before we get to that, because the whole Indianapolis speech is obviously a very iconic moment in this. There's also in that scene is another moment that I really love. And that is everyone comparing their scars and their injuries.
Yes.
And it's just great. But the Indianapolis monologue is a wonderful moment, harrowing, the whole scene. One of the most powerful monologues in cinema, really.
Yeah.
It's definitely really great. And then comes after that a moment of levity where Richard Dreyfuss starts singing. And you want to do it with me?
Yes. And a one, and a two, and a one, two, three.
Show me the way to go home.
I'm tired and I want to go to bed.
I had a little drink about an hour ago,
and it went right to my head.
Boom,
boom, boom, boom.
Wherever I may roam. Does it get worse and worse as we go? So we play the
on land or shore or foam.
You will always have me singing this song. Yeah, I'll play the real thing for a second here.
Show me the way to go.
They do it better, sort of.
I'm tired and I want to go.
This is in my head all the time, Sam, actually. But like, honestly, anytime like I am stuck at work late, like this song pops into my head. And then I think like some sharks are going to probably attack me through the window.
No, it's brilliant. And I love that moment right before that in the scar comparing scene where like there's one shot of Roy Scheider and he just like looks at a scar. He's like, no, I can't compete. I can't be.
Yeah. Yeah, he looks like, he's like, no. Yeah, no.
No.
Ahab was obviously a major influence on this. I think like Spielberg mentioned somewhere that he wanted to like somehow get rights to Ahab to be somehow more in the story. I don't really know. Like to make
they shot a scene where there's an introduction of Quint watching Moby Dick.
Oh, that's what it was, maybe.
And they filmed it, but then they had a rights issue where like the Moby Dick team was like, no, you can't use that. I've seen that scene. I don't know where I saw it. It was good, kind of jarring. I like it, but I do prefer his blackboard finger entrance. That's what they did instead.
So clearly he goes full Ahab in this movie, clearly, obviously. But what I think is really neat about the twist on this in some ways is that there's actually a scene in this where Quint is shooting the harpoon and the shark is dragging the orca. And this is like where Quint has really gone now full Ahab. And there's a turning point where Quint knows he's met his match and he's ready to die. And it's become where I think many times I watch this where like you kind of like in some ways hate Quint because, oh man, this guy's so arrogant. But really, it's fatalism. Like he is like, he's destroying the radio because he he wants to go down with the ship. He wants to fight the shark to the death. And he's accepted that he's probably going to die in this.
And he wants the glory too. He's like, yeah.
But what's interesting twist on this is that when Quint actually does die, he goes down like a chump and he is screaming at his fear and he's going down kicking and screaming. It is not a noble death.
No, it's violent and awful, and it's
undignified, and it's
yes,
and that's what's so ironic about this, that it's not what he envisioned it would be, and he's scared.
I love how scared he is, and I love at the end, towards the end, where like you see Quint's really afraid, and also Richard Dreyfuss is terrified once the boat stopped, and he's realizing like. There's that one line where Roy Scheider looks at Richard Dreyfuss. He's like, have you ever seen a shark do this before? And Richard Dreyfuss cuts him off and is like, no. Like, they are. I love how terrified they are at the end, because all their expertise and everything goes out the window. Yeah. They've never seen a shark do this before. Jaws is, like, no pun intended, showing its teeth, because, this is a shark, regular shark behavior. Then towards the end, the shark is, like, full-on predator hunting them down, and both Shaw and Dreyfuss are like, holy shit, like, we can't believe it's doing this, it's chasing us, I can't believe it. That's what I love about it. It just, Spielberg knows that he's got the audience, and he just ratchets it up as high as it can go. And I hear you, Quint's death, that's what I love about it. It's so preferable if he had this cool, like, smooth, like, I'll take him and like shoots him and then just gets sucked underwater. It wouldn't have had the same impact. I love the fact that his death was messy and violent and screaming and just like, it was just raw. It was great.
Yeah. So I think at the end, Brody has his stand, that boat's going down, and he shoots the oxygen tank. I think Mythbusters has said that this is not possible, but whatever. But
I love it. It's such a satisfying, like, yeah. Even though it's impossible, it's such a satisfying, like, blow up, smile, you son of a broom. It's perfect. I think in the Peter Benchley novel, he shoots it multiple times, and the shark just like sinks to the bottom. And like, that would have been so anticlimactic. After all that, I love the explosion. Spielberg, early on, before they were shooting, said this hilarious thing where the producers, Richard Zanuck and David Brown, hired him, and they're like, you did so well with Duel and the truck, and Spielberg wanted to do Jaws, but he said something along the lines of, I don't want to be known as just a shark and a truck director, which I thought was funny, because he's like, come on, guys, I want to be known for more than that,
right?
Which is hilarious.
And speaking of Duel, he did recycle that, the sound of, I don't know what, I forget what animal it was, but that roar when that truck goes over the cliff, you hear the truck like dying and roaring. Same thing when the shark is descending into the ocean after it's been blown up. You hear that same, exactly the same piece of audio, I think is what he said.
Recycled. Exact same audio, recycled audio. I love how he like thematically tied that in. I also like how the movie ends perfectly as they're swimming away. He's like, what day is this? And they're like, Wednesday or Tuesday, I think. I love that the movie just stops there and it shows a wide shot of them coming up on the beach, and the John Williams music is emotional. I like that there's no, it's just perfect. Like, it didn't need another 5 minutes where they're heroes and they're people interviewing them on the beach. Like, what happened out there, guys? Like, I find that movie, the end of the movie, surprisingly emotional. And one thing you reminded me of, how Quint's death is so brutal. I feel like everyone's death in that movie is very violent and animalistic. No one has a kind of stylized Hollywood death. Alex Kittner or Chrissy Watkins and Quint, all their deaths are so visceral and brutal and
especially the guy in the pond.
God. He's like, you guys okay over there? His death is brutal. Then when his leg just sinks down, like, oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think we've covered a lot of this. I think we're good. Yeah. I would like to get to our rating and our decision on this. But Sam, before we do that,
something in this field could be releasing the chemical into the air when there's too many of us together.
Don't eyeball me, boy. I see your mother driving up and down the street looking at me. I'd be your stepfather by the week.
It's a bad time, Bob. I'm serious. If I leave now, I'm not coming back.
You ever hear the expression? You got a face only a mother can love?
Let's just stay ahead of the wind.
It is time for Wallcasting, where we recast somebody from this movie with Mark Wahlberg. Now, I want to do this. I want to surprise you with this, Sam. And after I did this, I realized that this is actually not, could be easy or hard, but Mark Wahlberg was in a movie not that unlike this with The Perfect Storm. So it feels like this would be too easy. So I want to challenge you, Sam. Find somebody, maybe a deep cut in this movie. I have one, but, you know, where would you go with this? Because it feels too easy to just throw it. Like, you could replace Quint with Mark Wahlberg because he's done this.
So when you say a deep cut, you mean try to use Mark Wahlberg somewhere in the movie in a role that you would not think of him at first, is what
maybe
you're saying.
Maybe not. I got one.
You go first. I got to think about it. I'm fascinated. Okay. What do you think?
I want to recast him as Deputy Hendricks.
What's the matter with my printing?
So Hendricks, he's that like awkward, underprepared. He's that small town deputy I'm trying to figure out what other movies I've seen him in, but he's really good in this. But I just think that Mark Wahlberg would add something huge to this tiny role. Because picture Mark running out like he's in Lone Survivor, screaming like, "Everybody out of the water now! I don't care if you're in a kayak! Sharks don't care about badges!" He would overcommit to every task. Like Brody says, Mark, tape off the area. And he's like, "You want police tape or electrical tape?" He'd be overthinking everything. I got both in the truck. We got to lock down the beach tighter than Fenway Park during the playoffs. He would totally overcommit to everything that Brody asked him to do.
That is brilliant. He would definitely be intense. That's a good one. By the way, speaking of Hendricks, I will say a really brief mention. I'm not going to go into it. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time. Jaws 2 is a decent sequel. Obviously, it does not hold a candle to this film, but I've always enjoyed Jaws 2. I must say, not to throw Hendricks under the bus, but the actor who played Hendricks gets a lot of screen time in Jaws 2. And man, some of his acting weaknesses come through. I feel cruel saying that, but that's like, because he's this perfect side Spielbergian character. But in Jaws 2, Hendricks is front and center a lot. And some of his lines, man, I feel bad. Acting is a challenge. I'm throwing him under the bus, but I have to say what I feel. My apologies. And I know his name and I'm blanking. But let me see. Mark Wahlberg. Boy, there's such, as you say, low-hanging fruit.
Jeffrey Kramer is the actor.
Jeffrey Kramer, I apologize. You did a worthy job. Maybe it's not your fault. Gino Zwark directed Jaws 2. But you got a bigger part in the sequel. It's pretty cool.
Jeffrey Kramer's still with us. He's 79 years old.
Oh, happy to hear that.
And I'm going to... I will...
My apologies, I'll Jeffrey send Kramer. Him a, you're the
send,
man.
I'll send him a link to the show. Not only has been dissed by you, he has been recast by me.
Poor guy. He's a good guy. Mark Wahlberg. Oh, my God. I'm trying to think of, oh, God, who the hell, who would I pick? Man, I mean, I was going to go with the obvious Brody, but it's way too wild. I can't do it. I mean, his Brody would be so energetic. He'd be like, We're not only going to have to close the beaches, we're going to have to hire someone to kill the shark. This is a big deal, Bob. You can't do this. I don't know. Maybe I cast him as the guy. I think it's Ben Gardner who has that shot where he's like going and he's like, "Wait till I see what our mothers chase a blah, blah, blah." And he has, I would do that, but with Mark Wahlberg's high, like M. Night Shyamalan energy, where he's like, "Guys, we got to catch it. Get the dynamite. We're going to get the shot. If we don't get it first, they're going to get the money. We need the money. I got a wife and I got kids and the summer season's running out. I need $5,000. Throw that thing in the water." So, yeah, I guess I'd cast him as Ben Gardner.
That's good. All right, let's get to – I forget. Do I have a bumper for our verdict? I don't remember. I don't know. It's been a long time. It's getting late, too. So let's talk about our rating and vault decision on this. Sam, what is this movie? Is this a good movie? What do you give this from 1 to 5?
I would give it 2.5. Not very suspenseful. No, I can't even joke about it. Like I was like hurting my body on a cellular level. I mean, for me, this is the movie that got me interested in movies and is the reason why I took an interest in directing in the first place. So many people say that this movie is just iconic. It's beloved across the world. I'd have to give it, for me personally, 5 stars, and absolutely I'd put it in the vault. Bet you didn't see that one coming.
Didn't see that one coming. And I have nothing more to say about this. I don't think we've said a single bad thing except for the one shot that you just think is shit.
And the shot isn't that bad. I just thought the guy's acting was really cheesy when he stops. Okay. He's like, what's going on?
Yes, this is a 5-star movie. Yeah, it's in the vault.
Yeah.
All right. We've added to it. So, yay. It's been a while. Let's see what's left here. We are just going to, let's do our recommendation shelf.
Sir.
What?
Are either one of these any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You mean you haven't heard anybody say anything about either one of these?
Nope.
Well, what about these two?
Oh, they suck.
All right, time for recommendation shelves, where we recommend a movie I guess as a double feature with Jaws. And to this episode, we wanted to go with High Seas Adventures, something as a theme with Jaws. I just pulled this out of my ass. All right, you know, what can I say? Sam, I was kind of like throwing this out. I was predicting you were going to go with Master and Commander. So I was hoping that you wouldn't, but
I will not go with Master and Commander. The joke here for anyone listening is that I've recommended that movie about 4,000 times during the 100 episodes previous to this. And
that's
back
more before. Recommendations than we have episodes, Sam. How is that?
Yeah. So basically I recommended it like 200 times per episode. That's right, terrible math, but something like that. Do recommend it. Love that movie. But for this, I will go with a different route. I would say if we're doing a double feature, it's hard because after you watch Jaws, there's nothing that can top it. So I don't know what order this would come in. This is a movie that I find interesting. It's very flawed. It's not perfect. I've always been a big Ron Howard fan. Sometimes his films are hit or miss. His great ones are great. And some of the ones that miss, really miss. This movie is kind of in the middle. It's called In the Heart of the Sea. Came out in 2015, early December, and got smoked by The Force Awakens. Like, it just did not box office death. But it's an interesting movie about a novel that is based off the real white whale that Herman Melville was inspired by, what he based his novel Moby Dick on. And I forgot to write notes, but I think the name of the ship in the movie is the Endeavor or something like that. But it's based on a real story. There was a white whale that wreaked havoc on a whaling ship and kind of put a chink in the armor of the whaling industry, because this had not happened before. Really interesting movie. Chris Hemsworth is in it. I like it. It's flawed. It has some not great computer graphics and a kind of an odd pace, but it starts in New Bedford and we see the world of that. Ron Howard makes some interesting directorial choices, and it really is a high seas adventure. They go way out into the doldrums, out past South America, around into the Pacific. Some really cool, spectacular scenes with the whale, and not to reveal everything, but they do get stuck on an island and they have to resort to cannibalism. So it's an up and down movie, but I've always enjoyed it. I've watched it a couple times. I would cautiously recommend it. It might not be for you. It's oddly filmed, strange editing style, weird color grading. There's a lot of green hue in this movie, but it's an experimental film. I enjoyed it. I would recommend In the Heart of the Sea. Interesting Ron Howard movie. And I love the score. I'm blanking on the name of the composer. I know that, but the music is amazing, and I've played it in my car over and over again. So
I see here, is it Roque Baños?
Yes, Roque Baños. That's it. It is a moving score. I love it. The score is like makes the movie for me, I think.
I'm glad you brought this up, because this is a movie that I saw and then completely wiped from my memory. I know I saw this, and I think it's because I was really looking forward to this, and I think I was disappointed by this. I don't remember much about it, but I'm curious if it might land on me differently now.
I can really understand that. It really is not great. It's kind of all over the place. And if you were really looking forward to it, like, I can see it disappointing. I just came into it blank with no expectations, and I find it very atmospheric, and I like the scenes with Brendan Gleeson, and the actor who plays Herman Melville also played Q in the last few Daniel Craig movies.
Ben Whishaw.
Their interaction is great. I just find the atmosphere, and so it's flawed, but it's a really interesting movie. I like it. I would give it a solid 3 stars, but you can't, if you're expecting this incredible movie that's going to be like, that's going to rival Jaws or be like spectacular, you'll definitely be disappointed.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment because I don't really remember much about it. I just think that it was probably in 2012 that I actually did read Moby Dick, and I was trying to like get that cinematic experience, and it didn't land on me. But hey, you know what? I might be worth watching again sometime. I don't know.
The trailer for it was incredible, probably better than the overall film, but yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for that recommendation. The movie that, I am recommending is called All Is Lost. Have you seen this one, Sam?
I have seen that movie. Okay. I enjoy it. Yeah.
This is one I really like, and it holds a couple special places in my life. So first off, I got to meet J.C. Chander back in, I think, 2012. Okay. And he just came off his debut Margin Call. Which
love that movie.
It's really interesting. It's almost like a Sorkin-esque story about an investment banking firm which is trying to navigate this financial crisis. It's a cool film.
Zachary Quinto is in that.
He spoke at Indie Film Week, and I got to ask him a few questions afterwards, and they're probably really stupid questions, I'm sure, but I won't forget that moment. So he was almost like a nobody back then. I think that movie hadn't even come out yet. I'm pretty sure he was talking about it. So anyways, but years later, All Is Lost came out, and actually many years later, and that became one of my favorite films. But I've returned to this film several times for various reasons. And just to give some context, it's about a man played by Robert Redford, I think in a stunning performance, battling the elements in a fight for survival alone in the open ocean. But what I love about this film, that it's almost entirely dialogue-free. And when you think about it, it almost makes complete sense. If you're stranded at sea and no one around, you're not probably talking all the time. You're just doing.
Right.
And Redford emotes so much with just his eyes and expressions. And that's what actually, I think he's perfect for that, because he's got, at his age, he's got such this like wrinkled up face, and his eyes say so much, even more before he had all that plastic surgery, which is too bad. But still, it's perfect casting. And honestly, it's probably my favorite performance of his in the last 25 years, maybe since The Last Castle, which is one of my favorite films of his in the last.
A good movie too. I love that. Yeah. I saw that recently, actually.
Yeah. So this film also had a big influence on me when I was preparing for one of my own projects a few years ago called The End Is Nigh. And I made that with my daughter, Chloe. And this was like mandatory viewing for me and Chloe, as I want her to study Redford's performance to see how you can communicate without saying anything at all. And I think Chloe actually did a really good job in her performance. And so I guess I should probably go ahead and thank Robert Redford for that and how well she did. But it's really, truly, I think, a masterclass in that style of acting. Yeah, this is why I love the film so much. And it's just so much tension and that mounts in this film. So I love this film, and it's just one man by himself battling the elements. I love movies like this.
It's also brutally realistic and suspenseful. You just watch and you're like, oh my God, totally unrelated. Literally just made this connection now, but in The Heart of the Sea, there's the actor Benjamin Walker. He is like 1 year younger than me. I really like him a lot. He plays Gil-galad in The Rings of Power, and I just now realized it was the same person. He plays the captain in The Heart of Sea. Random fact, but I like him as an actor a lot.
I was wondering where else I've seen him in things. I have to, yeah.
Yeah, I literally did not think of that until just now. I was like, wait a minute, that's the same guy.
Wow. I feel like there was, I know what you mean, yeah. All right. So those are our recommendations for this episode. that probably brings us to the end. Is there anything else we want to mention? And anything recently you saw that you want to talk about?
I would just give a quick shout out to, I saw the live action, the 2025 How to Train Your Dragon, and I honestly thought it was decent. I agree with all the reviews that say, honestly, there isn't quite a justifiable reason for the movie to exist.
Yeah.
Because the third animated film only came out 6 years ago, and clearly, like, they want to milk the profit, because what Hollywood company doesn't? But I must say, I found it to be a cut above a lot of other Disney live action remakes. It's not Disney, it's Universal. But I thought the heart of the story was there. I thought the flying sequences were great. I actually really enjoyed it. This is just a stylistic thing. They look like, the costume design and the look of the movie, they look like sometimes like amusement park cosplayers. And I would have preferred to have seen a very gritty, realistic, dark Viking world. But that being said, I thought Gerard Butler's performance was excellent. I thought he added a lot. And I thought the other actors were good. But if you want to see that movie, I would see it for his performance. He added a lot. And I thought the director, Dean DeBlois, did a good job of, clearly he's remaking the animated film, which he also directed, but he adds human weight and he puts in some story moments and changes it up where he can. Because I think Universal's ultimatum for him was to make the exact same movie again. And to his credit, he changes some things up, some improvements, some interesting character developments, which for me made it worth seeing. So I was pleasantly surprised. I did not think it was going to be great. I enjoyed it. I'd give it like a B+.
Well, you say, like, how do they justify, why does this movie exist? Well, as of today, $220 million is why it exists.
That's exactly why it exists. Exactly.
And already the sequel has been greenlit, so duh.
Yeah, which I don't mind, because I thought the second animated film was okay, but I'm actually looking to the live action sequel because it might be better. The first one's a classic. The second one I feel is muddier storytelling, so I can't wait to see what they do with the live act. Why not? I'm on board. Do all three of them. I'll be there.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I don't know if I was going to see this. I was not in a big rush to see this because I am just really down on the live action remakes, but...
Oh, I hear you, man. Yeah. Me too, yeah. But I was surprised. I was not expecting to like it. I was kind of surprised.
I will say I did take my kids to see the Lilo and Stitch live action, which I actually thought was not bad at all. So... I'm contributing to this problem. We loved it, and it actually wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. The only other thing, I have not been to many movies out and about. I've been so busy. We didn't really do a catch-up session, you know?
Right, yeah.
We could have done that up front, but I think it's good that we got into the movie. The one thing I'll just say is my movie watching has been limited lately. I've been so busy. I did a play in the month of May, which was a lot of fun, rewarding. But kind of glad we're past that. It was great. The only other movies I saw out, I saw you had on your list here as well, was Sinners and Mission Impossible 8. Sinners, I thought, was fantastic. I thought that
amazing.
Was, you know, one of the best movies I've seen in the last year or two. And Mission Impossible 8, I'd like to actually ask you about that. Where does that rank on your Mission Impossible oeuvre?
Well, here's the thing. I liked it. I thought the submarine sequence with Tom Cruise and the biplane sequence were amazing. I must say, though, I felt the movie was top-heavy with an enormous amount of expository dialogue and callbacks and hyping you up and remembering other movies. So much so that it was like, remember this, remember that, remember this character, what about this? There was so much hype and so much building. I found the movie to be a little bumpier and less fluid than what I felt were superior entries from the same director, like Fallout or Rogue Nation. I didn't think it was bad. I just thought it was a little, the stakes were so high. It was so hyped up. There was so much repetitive expository dialogue. I honestly think the film could have been a half an hour shorter. And I wish that there was more smaller action sequences peppered in. There was this really cool fight in the log cabin in the Arctic. And I felt that what some of the other films had were, you always have a huge, spectacular action sequence in all the Mission Impossibles. That's a given. I felt this film was missing some of those smaller scale set pieces. If they had a little more of that peppered in, a little bit shorter, a little less bludgeoning expository dialogue, I would have liked it better. I don't know where it falls in the ranking. But I think I even enjoyed the final reckoning. I mean, Dead Reckoning Part One slightly more than this film. Good, but I was kind of exhausted by it. But it wasn't bad. Decent review, but just a little. It put so much into it. It was like, this is the final one. It's huge, that I just felt run down by it a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know. Totally get that. I did like it. I totally hear you on the callbacks. There was a lot of like, and not just like, it was almost like just taking clips of like little montages of past scenes to jog our memory. I actually did take the time to watch the previous 7 films leading up to this last film in like a 2-week period, which was exhausting, but I'm glad I did it, because my God, if I didn't, there were so many callbacks to, I think, almost every single previous Mission Impossible movie, and some deep cuts too.
Deep cuts and callbacks. And I don't mind callbacks. Like, yeah. I think they're great, but the problem is when there's so many of them, they remind you of your experience of the other movie. Yeah. And it's like, but wait a minute, we're supposed to be telling the story of this movie.
Yeah.
This might be an unfair question, but I'm curious. Do you have a favorite Mission Impossible?
Well, I was going to ask you that as well. I think it might be it still could be Ghost Protocol. Because
yes.
the what is the tower? The tall tower.
The Burj Khalifa in yes. Dubai. Yeah,
that still is the pinnacle of Mission Impossible for me. That whole sequence, and Fallout is great. Rogue Nation is great. I don't know which of those three. It probably changes between those three, but those three is the sweet spot for the franchise. For me,
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. Honestly, I think Ghost Protocol might be my favorite one, even though I've seen Rogue One. I find
Rogue One,
I mean, Rogue Nation. I can't believe Rogue Nation. I find is really good for repeat viewings, but I feel like Ghost Protocol is probably a better. Ghost Protocol might be my favorite, but what you just said, I'm on the same exact. I feel the same exact way. Yeah,
and I'm high on Mission Impossible 3 too, because I think it actually is the best villain.
Oh, Philip Seymour Hoffman is great. Mission Impossible 3 has gone up. I saw it in 2006. I hadn't seen it for years. I watched again recently. I like it a lot. It's just a good one. Yeah.
It's got the least amount of stakes, except for it's got the best villain. But Philip Seymour Hoffman's like saying, like, I'm going to hurt her. I'm going to hurt her. Like, he is just, like, I just love him so much in that. And it's a flawed movie. There's a lot of flaws in that movie. And when I watched it again about a month ago, like, there's so much good in this movie. I think that's where we are introduced to Simon Pegg and a lot of the team in that. But yeah.
I love it when Philip Seymour Hoffman is like, Ethan, you hung me out of an airplane. Like, you can always tell someone's character when they don't have to be nice to someone.
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff. And there's a lot of things in that set the tone for the franchise going forward. And even more so with Ghost Protocol and Brad Bird, the way he handled it. But I'll go back to Mission Impossible 8 for just a moment, because it is very bloated. And I do kind of look at... There's two things I just want to mention. The major callback is obviously one of the characters that they brought back from the first Mission Impossible. I forget his name now. I'm blanking at it.
I liked that. That was great.
It's not just a little cameo. He's not just there. He delivers a really full character and has stakes and his wife in it. Like, I was really invested in his character. I want him to do more. I hope he gets work, this actor, because he's really good in this movie.
Me too. He was great. Yes.
On the flip side of this, I think one of the problems with Final Reckoning and also with Dead Reckoning is the villain. That we have this character, the bad guy really is not a bad guy. It's AI. It's this thing. And I think that was actually... when they were conceiving this two-parter was a mistake, because the only thing we have is one person played by, I think, Isai Morales. I think is that right? Or am I get the wrong person here?
No, I think
yeah, so. No, that's it. Isai Morales plays like the human personification of somebody who's sympathetic to this AI taking over the world. He is not a strong enough villain to carry this. And I wish there was something else. The fact that the bad guy is not really even a person, it's this entity. I hate the thing called the entity so much. I think it sounds cheesy. It sounds like they could not think of anything better. I don't like that. And I think it's a weakness to what I think is like one movie, this Dead Reckoning.
I hear that. I thought the entity was sort of mysterious in Dead Reckoning Part One, but by the second film, when like Tom Cruise hooks into it and like has all these like visions, I was like, what am I watching? Like a Star Trek Doomed? What is this?
It becomes like science fiction. And exactly. I think that Mission Impossible needs to stay in its lane and veer it off. Stick with the stunts, keep into like espionage and stakes that maybe might need to be more tangible. I think it was a mistake going this route with the entity being the big bad. So that's all I really got. That I think it was okay.
Would you say that despite some entertaining set pieces that Mission Impossible 2 is probably the weakest?
It is my least favorite. I think that's
me too. Yeah.
Although again, rewatching that, it is John Woo. I mean, honestly,
yeah, I love John Woo. Like there's some great entertaining scenes. It just overall, tonally, the movie is a weird kind of misfire somehow, but I was watching it again recently and I enjoyed it more than I remembered, but comparing it to the others, especially Brian De Palma's, the first one that's like this full on like spy thriller, it doesn't quite work for me.
I think as the franchise moved on and kind of found its traction, the second one becomes a weaker entry because it's such an oddball in the franchise.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Like it's, yeah, I don't know, but that's, yeah, I guess that's how I feel. Yeah. Well, anyways, I can't think of that. There's more movies we could probably catch up on talking about, but I think that's okay for now. I would just want to ask you one other question, Sam, and this summer. All right. If you're going to see one movie this summer, what's it going to be?
If I could only see one movie
coming out in the theater.
If I could only see one movie coming out in the theater, just one, and there's a bunch of them that I want to see, but if I was only allowed to see one, yeah, I would see Nobody 2 with Bob Odenkirk, because that looks so hysterically
interesting.
Just exactly like I love the first one, and I just, the trailer is so over the top. It knows exactly what it is. I have a feeling I'm going to have a blast at that movie. If it's what I think it's going to be like, I can't wait to see it.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
But it's hard because there's others I want to see. If I had one choice.
I thought totally. Well, I know you were kind of soft on the Jurassic World trailer, you were saying. But I'm
really looking for, like, I'm going to see it. No question. I'm going to go see it. I'm going to see it on IMAX. Like, I will absolutely not miss it. I love Gareth Edwards. He did Rogue One. And I even liked his 2014 Godzilla movie. Like, he does action in a way I enjoy. I'm on board for Jurassic, but I just chose Nobody 2 because if it was the only one I was allowed to see, it has a slight edge. But of course I'm going to go see. I never get tired of dinosaurs chasing people.
I know. Okay, but one movie you're seeing, Nobody 2. That is
Nobody 2. Nobody 2, official. Right.
I'll just say, I think I have to see Superman. You know,
Oh, my God. I forgot about that. Yeah, of course. Fuck. Yeah.
No, you're seeing Nobody 2, all right?
I'm seeing Nobody 2. No, you know what? Nobody 2 still wins for me. If I had one choice, it's Nobody 2. I'm standing by that.
Okay. I'll be in my theater. You be in your theater. All right. Okay.
Well, I'll see you at the popcorn stand.
Okay, there. Fine. It's fine. All right. Well, I think that about does it. Right, we did it. We made 101 episodes. I feel like now we have this odd number. We're committed to going to 200 now. No, I'm only kidding.
We should definitely do the Odyssey next summer. I think that'd be fun.
The Odyssey. What's the Odyssey?
The Chris Nolan Odyssey. Oh,
I forgot that's what it was called. I thought it was still untitled. Okay, cool.
Maybe it is untitled. I don't know, but it's based on the Odyssey. Whatever it is, it's going to be. Who knows?
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, that is it. Unless I'm forgetting something. No, that's it. Let's just go. Let's go to bed. All right. All right. We're done. All right. Hey, it was fun. Who did it? All right. And I should probably do the host outro because That's what I used to do, right? Yeah. That is our show for the week. Back to the Frame Rate is part of the Westin Media Podcast Network. Thank you to Brian Ellsworth for our show opening. On behalf of all of us, we bid you farewell from the fallout shelter. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe and leave a rating review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. Because you never know, we might do another episode someday. Yeah, you never know. You will always find our episodes at backtotheframerate.com. This is the end of our transmission. Back to the Frame Rate, signing off.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.